Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Fantasy freaks and geeks, it's James Kell from the Sleeper King Football Podcast. We all know sleepers can win you championships, but finding these guys takes time. That's where the Sleeper King comes in. Let me do all the research so you don't have to. Every week, I'm going to break down which sleepers you need to pick up off the waiver wire and which surprise deep sleepers could help you win the week. Every episode, just 15 to 20 minutes long, every Tuesday through Friday. Subscribe to the Sleeper King Football Podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your pods.
From Lawrence. Lawrence writes, listening to you yesterday, I disagree that this is the best playoff team of the last 25 years. 2005 had a better chance. 2007 had a better chance. And 2012 definitely was a Super Bowl contender. Thank you, Lawrence. Appreciate it. You can follow me on Twitter at Kevin Sheehan DC. And you can tweet to me. I mean, I think I think right now the team with the position they are in the NFC, the chances of advancing deep into the postseason aren't as great as maybe they were in 2012. And perhaps in 2007, different story. Washington totally backed into the postseason in 2007 after Sean Taylor's passing. And there were really good teams. Green Bay was an excellent team. Dallas was an excellent team. Washington had to go on the road and play Seattle in the first round. They lost 35-14, even though it was a close game. 2007, there was not with Todd Collins that was not a better team. That was not a team that had a better chance. So I'll take them out of it and focus more on the 2005 and the 2012 team, because the 2015 team didn't have the chance that this team has. They played a home game as a division winner in 2015, but there were good teams in the NFC. Carolina that year with Cam Newton, they were 15-1. The Cardinals were really good that year, I think, with Carson Palmer. Was Carson Palmer the quarterback in Arizona in 2015? I think he was, because they were really good that year. And they ended up winning that playoff game against the Packers in overtime. But anyway, this is the best team Washington's had since 19 in terms of their capability because of the quarterback. This century, okay? And I'll include the 99 team with Brad Johnson. That was a really good offensive football team. That team actually is comparable. But to your point, Lawrence, the opportunity to advance may not be what it was in 2012. In 2012, the 49ers were really good, but they hadn't been there before. And the Falcons were really good, but they really hadn't been there before. And, you know, Washington was sitting there as a division winner, having won 7 games in a row. You know, I felt going into that postseason that they had a chance to make a run. And they did, because they were up 14-0 against Seattle at home when RG3 went down. That team was playing well on both sides of the ball. It was unstoppable as a running team. And, you know, they would have played Atlanta the following week. Seattle went and lost to Atlanta by 2 points. Atlanta ended up playing the 49ers in the NFC title game in Atlanta, and the 49ers won that game, went on to play the Ravens in the Super Bowl. But remember, the Washington had beaten Baltimore down the stretch, a team that won the Super Bowl. They were playing great football, and they had Seattle in trouble. That was probably the best opportunity. 2005 was a pretty good opportunity as well. The team played really good football down the stretch, really well-coached team, a tough physical team with Clinton Portis, and probably the best defense they've had during this century. 2022 was pretty good, but the 2005 defense was excellent. And there was nobody that was really unbeatable. I mean, that was the Sean Alexander year in Seattle. And Seattle ended up making it to the Super Bowl. Washington won the playoff game, remember, at Tampa, and then had Seattle in trouble early. You know, Carlos Rogers had that pick six in his hands, and it would have been 10-0. And with the way they were playing defensively, if they had held on, they would have played Carolina in the NFC Championship game. You know, that would have been in Charlotte. Because they had a better record than Washington. It would have been the two wild card teams playing in the NFC title game. But I think in terms of the team right now, because of what they are offensively and mostly because of what they are at the quarterback position, I think this is the best opportunity that they've had. You know, 99, they had to, you know, win a wild card game, which they did against the Lions. And then they were very close to beating Tampa. But St. Louis was the greatest show on turf in their first year. And even though Tampa did come close to beating them in the NFC title game, I don't know. And I felt that team, kind of like this team to a certain extent, wasn't near good enough defensively. The 99 Skins, they gave up a lot on the run. They gave up, you know, they had to outscore people in 99. You know, that was the year, remember, with Brad Johnson, that they had some moments early in the season where they were scoring 40 and 50 points a game. Go back to the beginning of 99, and they beat the Giants in week 2, 50-21, but that followed, remember, the Rocket Ishmael game, 41-35 in overtime. I mean, they were not a great defensive team that year. I feel the same way about this team. That team may have been a little bit less capable defensively than this team. And Brad Johnson was incredible that year. He threw for over 4,000 yards. You know, in the time, 1999, 24 touchdowns, I think 10 or 12 picks, something like that. He had a great season, phenomenal season. You know, and they had Steven Davis, and they had Larry Centers, who had a big year, and B. Mitch, who was, you know, still on the team, and he was a significant factor. They weren't great at receiver. They had Westbrook on that team. They had Albert Connell on that team. But they were good, and Norv was, you know, an offensive coach, and he was a good, you know, game plan designer and play caller. They just weren't very good on defense. I think that while there's a lot that in the NFC that's really good this year, and the landscape is different than some of the other years, I still feel better about this team this year and moving forward than I have any team that they've had in the last 25 years. You know, going back to the 99 team. And I think it's all because of Jaden Daniels. I also think there's a level of confidence just organizationally, that you have a structure that works in the NFL, and you're not going to have, obviously, a meddlesome, horrible owner, you know, screwing things up when they start to get good, you know, with a Mike Shanahan or a Joe Gibbs, you know, as a head coach, or a Marty Schottenheimer, you know, or a decent situation with Brad Johnson in 99, and he wants Jeff George and brings him in, and it ruins everything. So, yeah, I feel, I know what you're saying, Lawrence, with respect, not to the 2007 team. The 2007 team, no. That was a Todd Collins quarterbacked run into the postseason. And they were good on defense that year. And Clinton was tough. And, you know, Cooley and Santana. But they weren't capable of making a run with Todd Collins. 2005 with Brunell, yeah, they had a shot. And 2012, no doubt. I mean, bottom line is, I think, really, the most bullish I've been about a Washington Redskin team, Washington football team, Washington Commanders team over the last 25 years was 2012. Because I felt like they were well coached. I felt like they had a dynamic, unique quarterback. They had a running back that was setting a franchise record. They weren't terrible defensively. They would become terrible the next few years. They were opportunistic, and the field kind of laid out with Seattle, Atlanta, and then San Francisco. I still contend that if RG3 doesn't go down in a heap against the Seahawks, they win the Seattle game, they go to Atlanta, they win, and then maybe they lose in the NFC title game against San Francisco. That would have been a hell of a matchup. You know, Kaepernick, with what Harbaugh was doing with Kaepernick after kind of watching what Kyle was doing with RG3 here and what they were doing in Seattle with Russell Wilson. You know, Alex Smith, you know, gets injured a little bit and they never go back to him because Kaepernick's a dual threat quarterback. And that's really, by the way, the dual threat quarterback team. Russell Wilson was a dual threat quarterback, but not to the extent that Colin Kaepernick was in 2012. I mean, he rushed for 180-something yards in a playoff game that year. Their playoff win over Green Bay in 2012, I'm going to pull up the box score from that playoff game because it was an insane box score from Kaepernick. And that really is the one example more than any other of a team making it to a Super Bowl with a true dual threat quarterback attack. 49ers, 45-31 over Green Bay. Kaepernick in that game, 17-31 for 263 yards, two touchdowns, one pick. And he rushed for 181 yards at the quarterback position. 16 carries, 181 yards, two touchdowns. That performance doesn't get talked about enough when you think about it. That's a divisional round playoff game. That is the Packers with Aaron Rodgers. That is, I'm going to see if I can find it anywhere. I'm going to guess that the Packers may have been favored in the game. No, they weren't. They were a three-point dog in the game. But that is one of the unheralded individual playoff performances in recent playoff history. Kaepernick threw for 263 and two touchdowns and rushed for 181 and two touchdowns. 444 yards of total offense and four touchdowns. Not bad from the quarterback spot. Could we see something like that from Jaden in the postseason? I mean, Russell Wilson had some really good playoff games, and Seattle obviously won a Super Bowl, and Kaepernick almost won a Super Bowl that year. They lost, obviously, the next week in the Harbaugh Bowl, or 2 weeks later in the Harbaugh Bowl. What did he do in the NFC title game? I'm just curious how he followed up that game. He only rushed for 21 yards in the NFC championship game. And then in the Super Bowl against the Ravens, Kaepernick was... No, that's not the game I have. Hold on. Against the Ravens in the Super Bowl, Kaepernick rushed for 62 and threw for 302. 364 yards of total offense, two touchdowns, one rushing, one. You know, Denton, I think Kaepernick's the answer to the question of, in the age of dual threat quarterbacks, the one who nearly won a Super Bowl. I know Russell Wilson did win a Super Bowl, but he was less of a dual threat in terms of the number of rushes in a game than Kaepernick was, or RG3 was, or some others like Lamar who have come around. He wasn't that same guy. You know, I don't think he was. Like, I'm going to pull up Russell Wilson's career in the postseason to see if he had like a 100-yard rushing game in the postseason.
I don't think Russell Wilson is as big of a dual threat as you do. I don't know that he's ever had a
in the early legs. Days of Seattle.
I think he definitely moved the pocket with his legs, but I don't know that they were ever running like a read option kind of deal with him.
Oh yeah, they were. Oh yeah, they were. Of course they were with what's his face. They were running it at the same time in 2012 as Washington was. They ran a ton of zone read and read option in those first few years, but. I'm just looking. So he did, like, in that playoff game here in Washington as a rookie, he rushed for 67 yards in that game. And then in the next game, they went on to Atlanta. He rushed for 60 yards. So he was running a lot, but not Kaepernick's 181. He did not have in his postseason career a 100-yard rushing day. In fact, his as a rookie, those were his two. No, he had with Seattle against the Packers in 2020, he rushed for 64 yards on seven carries. Some of that being scrambles, too. But, yeah, Kaepernick was truly not. Russell Wilson was better as a thrower. He just was. And Kaepernick, that was Greg Roman as the offensive coordinator that year. Obviously, he coordinated Lamar's first few seasons in Baltimore. And they were true, you know, dual threat. I agree with you that Seattle was a little bit less than that. But they ran. Why am I blanking on the offensive coordinator who's popped up here and there over the years in that 2012 team? But, yeah. Russell's had a few 100-yard days as a rusher. In his second year, he had a 100-yard rushing day. In his third season, he had three 100-yard-plus rushing performances. He had an 11-carry 122, 14-carry 107, and a 7-carry 106. That was a lot of zone read, Denton, in those years with Seattle. There's a lot of scramble, too. And then, you know, he started to slow down a little bit, you know, towards the late 20-teens and early 2020s. But early on, he was dual threat. But, man, the Kaepernick performance in that playoff game, that's pretty amazing, don't you think? I don't think people talk about that being one of the incredible playoff performances. And that game was sick. 45-31, it kept going back and forth, and they just, I think, pulled away late. But back to Lawrence, yeah, I think this team personally is the team that I am most optimistic about on the field and organizationally, but even on the field. It's a tough NFC minefield of teams to get through to do anything this year. And it's different than it was in 2005, different than it was in 2012. But I feel better about this team. Although, I don't know, maybe it's comparable with 2012. I was confident. You were a kid back then, but I was confident that they were going to, that they had a chance to make a run going into that postseason. You know, RG3's injury aside, he had played well in the season finale against the Cowboys. He rushed for, you know, 60-something yards in that game. And Morris had rushed for 200. They were 14-0. They were and then he got hurt.
He kind of tweaked it on that.
He did on the second touchdown, right?
Yeah, where he kind of skated in the corner of the end zone there.
Yep, exactly. That's really where he tweaked it, and then he went down in a heap after that. All the while telling everybody that would listen along with Dr. Beanie that he was fine. It was just the brace. Can't wait for that 30 for 30 on that infamous Seattle game and the 2012 season.
Well, did you see the news yesterday?
I did not.
He's going to be on the Netflix.
He's going to be on what?
He's on the Netflix. He's one of the, I guess, the studio analysts that they are going to have for the Netflix Christmas NFL games. So you'll get a healthy dose where you can't change the channel of your boy, Bobby Three Sticks.
Who's he going to be on with?
So they announced it yesterday.
He's not calling the game. You're saying studio stuff.
Yeah, he's gonna be studio stuff.
I'd rather he call the game. I don't think he was that bad at that. I think he was actually pretty good at that.
Yeah, well, Kevin, he can't go viral if he calls the game.
Exactly. I mean, this is going to be all about him on a pregame or postgame. Who's he doing it with? What's the lineup?
Kay Adams is going to be with him. Drew Brees is going to be with him. Mina Kimes.
Brees is coming back to broadcasting?
He's back. He's back.
Good for him.
With new hair, I think. Mina Kimes is going to be with him, I believe, as well. You get J.J. Watt on one of the broadcasts.
Okay, I'm not watching this. I'll watch the games, but this... nah, that kind of broadcast isn't for me. Necessarily. I want to hear really, really sharp football stuff. Everybody's looking for something different, I guess. What'd you say?
Manti Te'o is going to be there too. He's actually pretty good. He makes fun of himself a little bit, which I respect.
Yeah.
It'd be hard to do television if he couldn't.
All right. Expecting some news here today related to the team. I'll share that with you when we come back. We're going to talk to Andrew Brandt coming up at 12:35, Denton, right? Yep. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980 and the Team980.com. So Sunday's opponent is New Orleans in the Superdome. Washington will go into that game pretty healthy. Dan Quinn said yesterday, Marshawn Lattimore, you know, it feels like they've got some markers, as he calls them, or milestones this week, that he met some of the milestones that they had for him during the bye week, and they hope that he'll continue to, and that he'll be ready to make his debut Sunday against his former team. But the big news from Sunday was the injury to Saints quarterback Derek Carr. Well, after the game, it appeared as if the injury might be season-ending. And then yesterday, interim head coach Darren Rizzi said that Carr's injury was kind of week-to-week and they were going to take it day-to-day, but it was non-throwing hand. They also said he was in concussion protocol. But today, just moments ago, the Saints signed, and this is a familiar name, a reserve quarterback, veteran, Ben DiNucci. Remember Ben DiNucci? They lost to him at one point. Or they beat him. I think they may have beaten Ben DiNucci. Ben DiNucci signed by New Orleans today. That would be an indication that Derek Carr may be done, or at least out this week, which means that either Spencer Rattler or Jake Haener will be the starting quarterback. And for Washington, that means that they will enter a game this year for the third time against a backup quarterback. They faced in the Panthers game, they faced Andy Dalton. He was not their starting quarterback. Against the Cowboys, they faced Cooper Rush, not their starting quarterback. Technically, I guess Russell Wilson wasn't their starting quarterback, but he has been. And then Sunday, they'll get the opportunity to face either Haener or Spencer Rattler for the Saints. I think the Saints, when Carr was out the first time, started Rattler. They did not, but was that because Haener was hurt also, Denton? I forget the situation there.
I do not remember that situation. I thought it was because they wanted to give Rattler an opportunity.
Okay.
But it could have been because of an injury to Haener.
Rattler's three starts resulted in three blowout defeats, although there was that wild game against the Buccaneers where they were down big and they came back and took the lead, but then they lost 51-28, I think it was. And he took a lot of sacks in those games, didn't see it very well. He's the rookie from South Carolina. He was picked in the fifth round, played at Oklahoma before that. Jake Haener, the Fresno State quarterback, taken in the third or fourth round the year before. I liked Haener coming out. I actually thought that he had a chance to be a pro quarterback. He has played in seven games this year, including on Sunday, 14 of 29, 177 yards, one touchdown, no picks. The game that we're talking about portions of games. He came in against the Chargers on October 27th. For Rattler in that game. Rattler started that game, and then Haener came in. Remember, the Saints are also without Taysom Hill. He got injured last week and is done for the year. So, nice opportunity. Of course, facing Cooper Rush 2 weeks ago didn't really work out for them. But it looks like they will be facing a backup quarterback. I don't have a preference because I just haven't watched the Saints enough. Rattler seems to be the guy that they wanted to see more of. I don't know if they saw enough, and they'll go with Haener. We'll see. But it sounds like Washington will get an opportunity to face their third backup quarterback of the season. One other quick thing, because I think this news is coming today or tomorrow. The NFL will announce whether or not Washington and Atlanta in Week 16 will be moved to the Saturday of that weekend. They have five games earmarked for three of them to move to Saturday, December 28th for a triple header that day. The other two that don't get picked will play on Sunday. And there's other flexing possibilities. Like the Sunday night game for December 29th right now is Miami at Cleveland. That's currently on the books. It's possible Washington, Atlanta could be moved to Sunday Night Football December 29th. That's what happened with the Giant game a few years ago. They were earmarked to move to Saturday, and they moved him to Sunday night, the game that they lost at FedEx on the call that wasn't made in the end zone and on fourth down. So Miami-Cleveland could definitely be a possibility to move. The Monday night game that week is Detroit at San Francisco. That probably stays. But I would say that by tomorrow, Thursday at the latest, we'll know whether or not Washington's going to play Saturday, Sunday, or Sunday night. And it could be a Saturday night primetime game. The five games that are that are potential movers to Saturday: Denver at Cincinnati, that could be a big game; Arizona at LA to face the Rams; the Chargers at Patriots; the Colts at Giants; and the Falcons at Washington. That might be the game that has the most playoff wise riding on it, which means it could move to Sunday night. For Miami-Cleveland, I expect Washington to be in a primetime spot either on Saturday or Sunday night when we get the news. All right, Andrew Brandt will join us next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and theteam980.com. Andrew Brandt is with us. Andrew, longtime NFL executive with the Green Bay Packers. He is the executive director of the Morad Center for the Study of Sports Law at Villanova. And he is a contributing writer at Sports Illustrated, does a Business of Sports podcast, has a Business of Sports newsletter. You're a busy guy. Were you busier working in the NFL or wearing 17 hats now?
Yeah, always good to be with you, Kevin. It's a good question because I was spending more hours working for an NFL team, but you're just kind of around. You sort of, the coaches work late, so you got to be around. You go to the game. You don't really have a lot of jobs at the game, but you kind of support the team. So I guess my answer is I do a lot more now, but I can manage my time better. So I'm not sort of beholden to a team to sort of always be around, even if you're not really working. And what's interesting with all those job titles, something else has been coming up lately. I've been getting a lot of calls from college ADs.
Ooh.
Wondering about how do we transition our college football program into a pro football program from an administrative and business point of view. It's really an interesting
Very interesting. I want to cut you off for 1 second because I want people to understand specifically what you're talking about, because we're going to more likely than not, starting maybe as early as next year, have a completely different setup in college sports, which will include a salary cap. So my sense is you have a real understanding of this. Put it in layman's terms for everybody what college sports is about to do.
Yeah, Kevin, I'm talking about this because right before this call, I got a call from, I cannot release the name, but a pretty big-time Power Four football coach, and saying, just help us. So what's going on is there is now a settlement, and I don't want to get too legalese, but basically over the last 15 years, players have sued the NCAA for, in simplest terms, saying we can't do what other students can do. We can't get paid outside of these NCAA restrictions. And all of that has been loosened, as we know, over the past few years with name, image, likeness, but not loosened to a point of, hey, we're free. So going to court has resulted in what's called a house settlement. House is the name of one of the cases that have been consolidated. And this settlement, if finally approved, which we expect to happen early next year, will set up a system where, first of all, it'll back pay $2.7 billion to all the athletes who couldn't get NIL before NIL was legal. And then it will create a revenue share system where athletes will get roughly 22% of athletic department revenues. So for the big schools, that's going to be, you know, if we assume these big schools get about $100 million in athletic revenue. So that's going to be $20 to $22 million for not just football, but they'll get the lion's share of it. And this is now in a settlement form where a judge in California is going to give final approval, I think, in a matter of months. So what that creates is exactly what you said. A revenue share with 22% is basically a cap. So now these colleges need to manage the cap. And then they manage who they're bringing in. And this has already happened, where they basically have personnel departments like the NFL.
Right.
That are saying, hey, this high school kid in Altoona, PA, you know, we should give him $2 million. So this is all going to be happening soon, and colleges are ramping up. And people like me, I know Mike Tannenbaum's getting these calls. You know, we're just sort of, there's like, who can we talk to about setting up cap and contracts and legal and all that? So it's a new growth area.
So I have a couple of questions for you, and this was not what I anticipated us talking about, but I actually have had this on my list to do, and today's the perfect day because, you know, there's no game to talk about from our team over the weekend, and we got several days before they play the Saints. I do want to ask you about Jaden Daniels and what you think of the team. But so let's just say, you know, in Ohio State or in Alabama, 22% of $100 million, it's a $22 million essentially a salary cap. You said football will get the lion's share. Do you know what percentage that is? I'm just curious. Between football and basketball, I'm going to assume that it's north of 90%.
Yeah, I think football is going to be 75-ish percent. Basketball is going to be 15-ish percent.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right.
And then how will they go about in that salary cap? This is now players getting paid to play rather than these NIL deals. I'll ask you about NIL here in a moment, where, you know, it was kind of pay for play, but it wasn't supposed to be pay for play. This will be truly set up where players are getting salaries for playing. And I guess, how will they dole that out? This is probably why you're getting called to manage this cap and this budget, but then, you know, 100 players on a team, will they all be scholarship players now? How will they pay these players? How will they distribute the 75% of $22 million?
Along with the settlement money-wise, there's all these roster now limits, and it's going to affect the smaller sports. Roster limits and scholarship limits. Some of the scholarship limits are actually going up, but some of the roster limits are going down, and that's a whole nother discussion. But yes, they're going to have to determine where they can fit in. The thing to me, Kevin, is what people don't realize is right now college athletes, especially big-time football players, have more rights, listen to me, more rights than NFL players.
Yes.
NFL players sign contracts.
Right.
So after a year, they can't just go from the Vikings to the Jets because they feel like it, you know. They sign contracts that they can't move till 4 years in the league, and they have commitments. In college, you see this one-year deals. Basically,
it's unrestricted annual free agency for college athletes. Of course.
And without a salary cap.
Right.
So one challenge to this settlement now is from the state lawmakers who are challenging the settlement, saying, wait a minute, $20 million is still a cap. No one agreed to a cap. We, the Georgia lawmaker, says, we want to pay $100 million. Why should we agree to this cap? So if this settlement is not approved, then it's more chaos. But right now, the NCAA needs the settlement more than the players, because the players have all the leverage right now, at least the big-time players.
Well, not to mention just the idea of contracts and commitments that are longer term. It ends up benefiting, I think, the sport from a consumer standpoint. But let me just ask you, this isn't being collectively bargained. So how do they – George is kind of right, I mean, to a certain extent. I guess I'm just thinking out loud here. Is NIL going to go away or not?
Well, NIL has changed. It started in 2021. I was involved with it. It was like, this is great. Players can go to a steakhouse, get free steak for their quarterback, takes his linemen out. They're doing shout-outs at Instagram for for $500 of getting free meal kits or whatever. And then collectives got involved. And then college football got involved. And it's become pay-for-play. But previous lawsuits have basically said, you can't restrict NIL. So NIL has become, now it's legal. That's what it stands for. And yes, we're already in the boat where you're basically getting paid to play. Now they couch it in terms of you got to show up for this birthday party or you got to do these charities, but we know the deal there.
Right. I guess what I'm wondering is, the quarterback is going to get, you know, a portion of the 75% of the $22 million salary cap, right? He's going to get a salary. But will the quarterback also be able to cut an endorsement deal, NIL-wise, that maybe is more legit? Like, it's a true, I'm going to do something for this car dealership, and I'm going to get paid for it.
Yeah, and that creates all kinds of compliance issues, right?
If
the quarterback's getting $1 million under the cap, he's getting another $1 million from the car dealer outside the cap. So that's like, you know, that's like Jaden Daniels, you know, having the Commanders have a deal with some car dealer, like, you know, we can only pay X, but can you get him a couple million? It's just exactly what I'm saying is this is a cap without a cap and no collective bargaining. So you can see some people saying still not good enough for college athletes because they're restricted in any way.
All right, two more things on this. Number one is, are they really going to back pay $2.7 billion?
Yeah, that's the key feature of this settlement. We're talking a lot about going forward, but this settlement is about going back.
How do they dole that out?
And that's kind of the same formula. That's kind of mostly football, some basketball, and some other sports.
But then who gets it? Which teams? Which players?
Well, now that's these firms that come in and do these calculations. Anyone who's been involved in a class action,
right?
You know, like the concussion settlement or Vioxx settlement. You know, you got to calculate all those things. And as we know, with my saying, lawyers are going to get a lot of that.
Right, although in those cases, you're really looking at damages rather than revenue enhancement while you were in the sport. Like, it's kind of the opposite of it. What about the transfer portal? With the salary cap, will there, you know, like you said, they don't have contracts. Will they still be able to jump year by year?
It's a great question, because they are going to get contracts. Now, I read about this Michigan quarterback who flipped from LSU, who Larry Ellison is involved in paying $10 million, but that $10 million, what I read, is over 4 years. So I'm looking at that and like, okay, that's a contract.
Right.
So if this kid leaves after one, he only gets whatever, $2 million, but you never know. I mean, right now it's chaos. And that's why people are calling people like me, like, how do we get contracts on these kids? Right now they sign with these collectives, and I don't even know if these collectives are going to be around in April, because you don't need a collective. Now it's going to be the school. The collective has been this pass-through where the school is, quote-unquote, not paying them. Somebody else is, but I don't know where that goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, for fans of college football, college basketball, we can't, you know, put the horse back into the barn on all the conference right. reshuffling. All right, that's done. But I think just a sense of, okay, this guy's really good for us, and I get to watch him next year play for my team too. That would be a good start.
Yeah, I mean, I'm at Villanova. We have a whole new team, you know, this year, except for one
guy. So does Maryland. Yeah, pretty much.
So does Maryland. So does everyone. You know, I hear this all the time from fans. And basically, fans have understood now this new way is good for players, but who else is it good for?
Exactly.
Who else? Who else is this good for? And, you know, player advocates don't care. They're not concerned is not. Yeah, I mean, the thing is that you and I think a lot of people listening, are going to watch Alabama football, Penn State football, are going to watch Kentucky basketball, Duke basketball, regardless of who's on the team. And so you can make an argument like you're really watching the brand. There are very few players that make a difference.
Totally true. I mean, look, for years prior to NIL and Portal, I mean, I would make the case that the value proposition for the player was pretty good and that the players weren't nearly as important as the colors on the uniform and even the coaches who were really longstanding. And yeah, the programs themselves are brands. Now, with respect to college basketball, which I think is a completely different conversation, the sport's popularity is not what it was. You know, a lot of that is, you know, football season tends to mask everything. I mean, you know, the NFL does, college football does. But this, you know, the fact that you don't watch them in November and December, and then by the time you start watching as you approach March, you have to learn a whole new team than the team that played for your, you know, the team you root for the year before.
Yeah.
I think that sport's been hurt a lot by all this movement. I don't know if contracts would have fixed it, because football's hurt everything and it's, you know, left everything in its wake.
I do think people have to give up, you know, on the sort of the quaint notion of Christian Laettner and Bobby Hurley around for 4 years. You know, we're just not there. It's over.
Yeah, well, I mean, just look at the championship games. We had SMU playing in the ACC championship game on Saturday night. All right, let's talk some football with Andrew Brandt real quickly. So, I haven't talked to you in a while. What have you made of Washington's season so far?
You know, I think it's been everything people could hope for in terms of upside. So, it's hard for people to understand this, but when you work for a team, you're really looking at, you'd love to win this year, but do you have a foundation? Do you have a foundation for sustained success? And it seems like it's there. I'm not as close to it as you do. But the most valuable property in a sport that's worth $21 billion a year is a young ascending quarterback. And that's it. You know, it's like if you had to come down to one thing, to feel good about a franchise, that's it. And they have it. And I've seen some spotty play there, but you sort of look at the total book of business with Daniels and you're like, yep, they got the guy. You know, and will he turn out to be all pro? Who knows? But this is a guy you can build off. And I'm like every fan, like, oh, geez, is he going to get hurt? He's so skinny. But, you know, he's managed to play through that for a long time.
Well, and Andrew, you know this because you're from here, and that's number one. And number two is they have a completely different ownership structure and front office structure, which gives them a much better chance than what they had for 24 and a half years.
Yeah, and again, going to my expertise, that sale changed the game. And the reason NFL is allowing private equity and institutional money into their franchises, which I just wrote about in Sports Illustrated, is the Commander sale.
Yeah.
That's the tipping point. I've told you this story. I got a friend there. He's probably listening. He got a prospectus from Harris.
Right.
For 200, you know, we want $200 million. And he says to me, and all I get is parking pass and good tickets. And I'm like, yep, that's all you get. And if you don't do it, someone else will. So that's what we become. And I know Harris had trouble getting a group together with that price.
Right.
So that sale, in a good way for everything you're talking about, changed the game.
I could do this with you for much longer, but I am up against what we call the hard break, the hard out break for me at the end of the show. I love catching up with you. Business of Sports podcast, Andrew Brandt's podcast. You get it wherever you get your podcasts. He's got a newsletter as well. It's called the Sunday 7 newsletter. Follow him on X on Twitter, at Andrew Brandt, and you can find out more. Let's do this again soon. I appreciate it.
All right, Kevin, people are asking about, I do these reels too, talking about this stuff. So Instagram, Andrew Brandt 2 at Instagram.
Perfect.
Thanks, Kevin. Be well.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it. All right, back tomorrow. Chris is up next.